Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Oh, hello, it's Thursday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints, where the Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, and entertainment that's been inspiring and provoking us lately. Gathered around the table this Thursday, we've got Danielle Riendo.
Hi, hello, how are you?
Not bad. How are you doing on podcast two of the day?
I'm doing very well.
Now that I made you talk for two straight hours.
I'm doing well. I spent a lot of time in history. This week, as we'll see today, but also, you know, with the history of a beautiful Jane Austen adaptation and a history of a cultural revolution. So,
and we also have Patrick Klepek.
Yeah, here I am, right here, just for you, Rob. You told me
all
to show
energy.
Up. I'm here. I'm here.
When does Austen come back?
Not sure. I feel like it's negotiable.
Never.
It's a little bit negotiable.
Increasingly less so from my perspective. Anyway, no, sorry. I don't mean to drag you, Patrick. I love you. You know I love the energy you bring. All right,
I love your bromance. Can I just say, I love y'all's beautiful bromance. I want you all to watch football together and have snacks together, football snacks together, and drink beer.
All the sports meets.
Good. Please eat some sports meats together.
As long
on
as it's
couch.
Not ham. I'm just not into ham.
Okay.
All right.
Like a bite of ham. That's it.
Speaking of people not being into things, Patrick.
Yeah.
It looks like the reviews are in. Captain Marvel sucks.
Oh.
Yeah.
Which is weird because it's not out yet. But the fans have spoken.
All right. So, I cannot believe that this is how. I've not really paid attention to Rotten Tomatoes. I don't know if any of you I guess we can get into that maybe after we can talk about how we use aggregate sites and data to like sort of inform our cultural interest in what we watch and don't watch. But so I came across a story. You know, I'm a huge fan of the MCU. I follow film a lot outside of video games, and so kind of impossible not to. Have stumbled into. There's a piece on comicbook.com called Captain Marvel Review Bombers Have Dropped Rotten Tomatoes Audience Rating to Lowest in MCU, written February 22nd, 2019. And as you mentioned, Rob, Captain Marvel does not come out for as of this recording, I think another week, but as of that writing, 2 weeks. And yet somehow it had been review bombed into being the lowest rated in sort of Marvel's run so far. And that's like a user rating that is like separate from a critic rating used on the aggregate site Rotten Tomatoes. And then in the aftermath of that, Rotten Tomatoes announced that, hey, so you can no longer rate a movie that's out yet. Which that got...
apropos of nothing.
Well, honestly, like the way they wrote their bit, I don't know if I... I want to pull up their actual... statement because it was, you know, written very sort of matter of factly. Like, you know, we've had a talk. I'll just try and find it. But anyway,
okay.
You know, it struck me as completely strange that that was even a policy to begin with, given that even if you don't follow, film, like I'm sure you've at least heard of like the term review bombing. If you know, in games, it's very common, especially on Steam. Review bombing is a tactic used. In which
we just talked about it with the Devotion podcast.
Yes.
Yeah, we just talked about Devotion. And like it's a common tactic used by folks to target games for some specific reason. More often than not, it is related to, you know, quote unquote, social justice issues, whether it's like race or sex or gender. It can be, you know, it is meant to be used in,
well, hold
in
on.
The sense.
To be clear, though, it's not like I'm like, it's not like people are going out there being like, yo, this is not woke enough. we need to like tank this thing score. So it's not like it's not like social justice. It's, yeah, that's right. It's like the social justice brigades are like, comrades, we must storm the barricades of Rotten Tomatoes and really strike a blow against. Maybe something should have been done about Green Book. Maybe we all failed and like should have like mobilized as consumers to tank that fucking movie, but we didn't. And instead, what usually happens is something like this, or The Last Jedi, where it's like, yeah, hey, it's
Black Panther, like nearly all black cast, like Last Jedi, a movie that like sort of both as a female lead, but also is something that sort of stomps on the mythos of Star Wars in kind of a not quite a middle finger sort of fashion, but one that like deconstructs the thing that people like about Star Wars or thought that liked about Star Wars. And then Captain Marvel, not the first comic book movie to star a woman. That was, you know, Wonder Woman kind of got that sort of out of the way. But, you know, the first one in Marvel's universe. And so there's a very specific pattern of the kinds of people that are targeting these films. But I was just at first just taken aback that like this was even the policy in the first place. I guess they also announced that they were going to additional tools that will prove that you saw the movie, because Fandango, and this is where I started going down like a deeper rabbit hole with this, was like, I have never quite understood the relationship that Rotten Tomatoes, the cultural power that Rotten Tomatoes not just has amongst, I understand it's sort of amongst fans, because we see this in video games. Like, we see where people take little spots of perceived power that they have to make a point. That happens in review bombing on Steam. That in the past has happened with Metacritic. Seems like less so of a thing these days, where aggregate sites just have, maybe the notion of Metacritic has just moved more to like Steam reviews. I seemed like that used to be more of a thing in video games and is less of a thing these days. And that just got me reading all these articles about Rotten Tomatoes, like as a website. There's a couple I'll link out to. There's one from Vox called Rotten Tomatoes Explained, and then one from the LA Times called How Rotten Tomatoes Became Hollywood's Most Influential and Feared Website. And like I said, I just didn't realize that, like, I guess like maybe I knew that Fandango bought Rotten Tomatoes a couple of years back. And then one of the big changes they made was that because they were purchased by Fandango, a place that people buy tickets, next to where you buy tickets, they started putting the fresh or rotten aggregation, and then the user engagement sort of metric next to where you buy the ticket. And then what studios started finding was that while it can't necessarily, like the notion that Rotten Tomatoes can like make a movie flop or succeed is overblown, for a movie that has bad word of mouth and is hopefully just relying on trailers, like it can make a bad movie perform worse, and it can make a good movie perform better. And so it does then have like, can't have a meaningful impact on sort of the box office. And as such, it's given both a lot of weight by studios. And then that's also why fans have since come to find Rotten Tomatoes as like a very powerful weapon to wield, because it thus allows them to do things like drive away, like in The Last Jedi in particular. So like critic reviews were like 93%, and then the audience score was like 51%. And then Fandango put out a fucking tweet that was like, wow, critics and audiences split on The Last Jedi. Like, what do people think of that?
Right.
That's right.
Like, very much playing into and normalizing and encouraging like the awful, horrible behavior of the most toxic elements of the Star Wars fan community. So like, it's just all just weird. It's a weird website. It's a whole weird thing that I just didn't quite, it helped me grasp, like have a better understanding. Like, when I see these stories, why is every film site fucking writing about it? Like, I don't understand why an aggregate website is given so much goddamn importance. And then once you realize it's attached to ticket sales, like, oh, okay, that actually makes like a lot more sense.
I was going to say ticket sales, and also like, I do think it has a lot of clout maybe amongst the less online of us, but still people who use the internet. Like, my mom goes on Rotten Tomatoes every day, you know, like I imagine.
Does she actually?
Not literally every day, but whenever there's film reviews coming out.
Because I'm trying to figure out, like, who is the person? Are people actually doing that on Rotten Tomatoes?
They
must. Like, it's been purchased and sold a bunch of times and probably does. But I actually was trying to figure that out, right? Because I know that me, very plugged in games.
So, but I guess my question is, because my parents don't go to the movies. Like, they just don't. Right. But, like, Danielle, so, like, did your mom just keep up on movies via Rotten Tomatoes? Or is she, like, oh, I want to see something, what's good?
she does both. Like, she goes on Rotten Tomatoes, probably not every day, but probably weekly. You know, she knows a movie's coming out. She wants to read all the reviews. I don't know. I can ask her after this podcast if she reads the user reviews, but I know she reads the critic reviews, all of them, for pretty much everything. She's always up on, like, oh, this is coming out. You know, this is coming out. Have you heard about this? She's always sort of discussing that sort of thing with me. And I know she's got a bookmark. Not that she knows how to use bookmarks. I just set up a new laptop for her. So she's 68. It's fine.
But she uses it, right? Like, it's a regular part of,
yes,
like, her cultural diet that helps inform the decisions she makes in what she watches.
Absolutely. Yeah. And she watches trailers, like, religiously. She's constantly watching trailers. So I think it is the part of a normal sort of media diet for, like, a person who is relatively, you know, not as plugged in as us, but somebody who does keep up on movies, who does want to know what the sort of critical, you know, the general census on something is, at least from where the critics are concerned. But yeah, I don't think she's paying that much attention to, like, you know, Last Jedi women suck or whatever. I don't think she's reading those, but she is reading that site for
username
sure.
Taken. It's got to be 1234. You got to
add
another number to it.
Keeps going, you know?
Yeah, it's a really strange thing because it is also, I actually always liked the Rotten Tomatoes approach, which was that it would just, rather than the Metacritic thing, which at least for a long time had this semi-opaque, like, weighting system, and
right,
then would translate
does,
different score.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just think it matters less to the discourse
sure
than
yeah,
it
yeah,
used
yeah
to.
Yeah, yeah.
But it would translate different score systems into a 1 to 100 rating. I always liked the Rotten Tomatoes approach of, one, made it super easy to just find what, like, leading critics were, like, what, you know, critics in newspapers and shit were saying. But two, it also didn't try to get anything more fine-grained than, did a critic like this movie or not really? And there's still some reviews where you see, like, a fresh rating from, like, Manola Dargis or something, and you read a review that's, like, sort of positive but also really scathing, and it's like, how, like, coin flip as to whether or not that is actually a fresh rating. But I always liked the approach of, it seemed to be the smart way to approach aggregation. But for me, that's what it was doing. It was aggregating, like, just general critical consensus, and then it would be a way to navigate to actual, like, reviews from people I like, rather than having to go to, like, 8 different websites and look it up and crack 8 different paywalls. this was in the Halcyon days when every newspaper had a film critic. But then this whole, like, audience review aggregation is where things start getting really sticky. Like, for me, I probably don't care that much what audiences are saying, because that's one of those, you know.
Because what does it even mean, right?
Yeah.
Like, what is that number saying? Like, especially once, like, the veil is dropped and you realize that you didn't, like, it'd be one thing if it's like, hey, the people who purchased tickets through Fandango, they came back on after seeing the film. And, like, the ticket was redeemed. We know they saw it, or at least the ticket was used. Like, even if that's not useful to me, I can at least see where you arrive at a conclusion from there that, like, this is in some measure a reflection of an audience that saw a film. But, like, the whole notion, especially the fact that they, like, it only makes it all the more, like, irresponsible what they were doing and, like, the fire they were playing with, and that, like, the notion that they were fanning the flames of, like, this isn't just people saying, like, I don't like black people in movies. Like, these are, like, this is an extension of folks that are going out and actively harassing actors, actresses. Like, this isn't this is not limited to someone saying a 1 through 10 or whatever. This is, like, this helps inflame, like, actual meaningful bigotry that is being directed at the individuals that are in these films. Or TV or what have you. And the notion of, like, playing on that because, like, it's fun. Like, what's the it's actively harmful in a way that I don't think, like, they've been really held to account on. And the fact that they had to change to this mere notion of, like, the movie's out only underscores how the chasing of metrics, the chasing of engagement led to harmful behavior that, like, knocked certain people off social media because they didn't want to deal with this shit. And Rotten Tomatoes is not the end all be all. The one, you know, thing that the one match that set this off, but it sure as hell contributed to it.
Yeah, I was gonna say a lot of this reminds me of back in the day. 10 years ago or so, there was this book, this Jeff Jarvis. You know, I don't know if either of you ever read his blog or his book about making things googly. And, you know, is this ringing a bell at all? It's okay if it doesn't. This is sort of a
vague
notion.
Set it up.
No, I'm trying to remember.
It was a book, again, probably 2008 or so, maybe 2007, you know, a little more than 10 years ago. And it was very much about embracing user friendliness, you know, user reviews, user this, user that, making the world a more googly place. That was the whole thesis of this book, was that this sort of feedback is so great. And it kind of comes from this sort of utopian internet ideal of like, people are going to be reasonable and people are going to be helpful. And the more aggregation you can get, you know, of course, there'll be a few bad apples, but in general, the more aggregation of the more people writing, the more people sort of participating in this culture, the better things will be. And it just feels
the
like
the old utopian view of the internet from
very much so.
Wait, since is it found this to be just Jeff Jarvis?
He was a professor at CUNY for a while at the
yeah, but see. The like I just linked you the dude, the Jeff Jarvis that was like, we must crowdsource fundraising for the North Carolina GOP office.
Yeah, he sure is still going on that, I guess.
That's the same one?
That's the dude, man.
That's him? That's,
I was like, no. Why is his name Jarvis? Like, I was like, because I was confusing him with Jesper Joel, who's good.
Right.
And
not
so
not
I was like,
Jeff.
Wait, yeah. So Jeff Jarvis, so that's really interesting. So like in the dawn of the internet age, he's like, this will be utopian. Power to the people.
Very much.
This
so.
Cannot possibly go wrong. And then in 2016, he's like, "Damn, we just gotta help those North Carolina Republicans rebuild their office that was burned down."
It's a lot. It is a lot. And it just reading this story just brought me back to that book. Not that I read the whole thing. I read like four chapters, and I was kind of like, I don't know about this stuff, guys. As I was a lowly grad student learning about culture and art and all these other kinds of things, it just. Oh, shit. Did that ever fall on his face, that utopian ideal? It's
well,
a lot.
I think, though, one of the reasons it does, well, I'm curious what you guys think of this.
Yeah.
Here's my pitch. So the utopian idea is that all this stuff is going to help us make better decisions. We're going to crowdsource more information. We're going to be able to just provide feedback on a whole host of experiences and help people find what they're looking for, but also sort through the dizzying array of choices we face as consumers in a modern society. But the problem is all the ways to help us do that are run by sites who ultimately begin relying more and more on engagement, right? Like Rotten Tomatoes, the relationship I always had with it was really simple and transactional. Go to Rotten Tomatoes. Look at the score, maybe link out to a couple reviews. Don't open Rotten Tomatoes for a week.
Right.
You know, until the next movie night. I'm trying
it's
to
like,
figure
hey,
out
what movie
what
you want to see. Yeah. Is that any good? I'm
going
to go
check.
Look. Oh, it's green. Cool. Well, all right. Well, maybe we'll go see that on Friday.
Yeah. So we're not like opening and closing like Rotten. We're not like living on Rotten Tomatoes all
it's
the
not
fucking
a
time.
It's not a social network. And like that's.
But it becomes that if you allow it to like enable fucking campaign, like if you are encouraging people to like sort of take a corner on a movie, like join the discussion, like lead the conversation. What are your reviews say? Like is that maybe part of what is happening here? I don't know if Rotten Tomatoes has gone as far down that rabbit hole as Steam has. But when I look at the way Steam user reviews go and everything Steam has done with curation and user reviews, trying to get more and more community activity for a game to happen on the Steam forums, on the Steam pages, it all feels to me like, yeah, it's also allegedly for helping people get information about a game, but really, it's about to sort of keep you in the hall of mirrors that is like modern consumer website design.
Yeah.
Well, especially because Steam's, the most recent change to the way user reviews work, because the way what would often happen, and this happened with Devotion, right? Was that the new one?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Was that like the short term of a review bomb is like that game went from, I think like the highest praise on Steam is overwhelmingly positive. And then it was bombed with something like 15,000 like negative reviews that brought it down to mixed. Now that is supposed to average out over time to something that is closer to what it actually is, because the way like Steam's response was like, oh, we'll just give you charts. And so you'll notice that like in this period, overwhelmingly positive. In this period, very negative. Something must have happened. And like in the Steam's bullshit utopia, in a which is like harkens back to this, what Daniel, you were just talking about, is like, oh, what they're thinking, their hypothesis is like, oh, like there was a bad patch, like it caused crash in the game or saved games disappeared. And then the community left bad reviews for the game. And so that shows you something went wrong. Then it was fixed. And once a new patch is issued, you can leave a new review. And then look, it's like, it's positive again. And that's just not how that works. Yeah. Like that is just not how people engage. And like, there's such overwhelming evidence at this point where that is nakedly not how people use it. So to continue pretending under that facade is not ignorance or even being disingenuous. It's like willful malice. Like, I mean, I would argue Steam does that and then dresses it up in fancy rhetoric or points to an algorithm. Whereas Rotten Tomatoes, like doing things like social media, like seeing what happened to Black Panther and Last Jedi, like and actively like putting out, you know, tweets that are like riffing on this stuff, is like, you know that people are being hurt by this. You know what the numbers are showing you. You know what people are writing. You just don't care because at the end of the day, you get to do a social media engagement meeting at the end of the month and go, way up.
Yep.
Man, way up. Like, that's cool. Just keep doing what you're doing. Because actually a divided audience is good for them. Like they actually don't want consensus. Like consensus helping people does not necessarily track with increased traffic, increased engagement. And when you're increasingly driven by in engagement as your like primary metric, if that undergirds how you're profiting off of the endeavor, you know, that leads you to do extremely bad things that have extremely bad outcomes.
That's so depressing and so correct.
I guess to extract it out from this, is there any like data either of you use? I mean, Rotten Tomatoes is one example, but are there sort of like data points or aggregation or anything that's like in that world that either of you kind of use when you're trying to sort through just stuff? You know what I mean? Like for like one example is like, it's not an aggregation necessarily, but like everything in my house, I go to the wire cutter.
Okay, like, well, the wire cutter.
In some ways, it's an aggregation. In some ways, like the picture of the wire cutter is, if for people who aren't familiar, is like, oh, we're going to test everything out, and then we're just going to tell you on a general range of, like, the best, pretty good, and you're cheap. Like, you could still get this one, and it won't, like, burn down your house, and it'll be fine. And it's just, like, rather than having to sort through reviews of, like, 1,000 different printers. Like, this is how I bought my most recent printer. Rob, I don't know if you ended up buying it after my recommendation.
I did.
It's good? It's a good printer?
It's awesome. I love it. Thank you,
right.
Patrick.
And
thank you, Wirecutter.
Well, thank the Wirecutter.
Wirecutter, sponsor us.
But I mean, that's just like, that's what's like, I find like the Wirecutter extremely useful because there's so many things that I don't want to do. Like Amazon reviews, I know are manipulated. Like anything that's on like any of these commerce websites is not fucking useful to me. And so the Wirecutter has always been like a very useful metric for things that like, I want something that's good. I do not want to put the effort into trying to figure out where I would even go to learn about the best, you know, like robot cleaner. I just want, just tell me the one that's like 150 and that like works and it'll last for like 28 years, for like a couple of years.
I have a 3-part system for all of these things in my life, which involves one,
right,
internet research, which does include things like Amazon reviews or reviews on the Wirecutter. I do just like a spread of all the things on the internet. Then I go to Twitter and I ask my Twitter followers about the same thing. And then for certain things, I will go to real life friends and be like, here is the research I have found from my 2 different types of internet searches. What things track with you, dear real life friend? And from there, sometimes I make decisions.
I think I have mixed feelings about the Wirecutter, mostly because I'm a little bit creeped out by the degree to which I'm beginning to rely on it for things that I used to not need reviews for.
Yeah.
Or I didn't think I needed reviews for them.
Like, but they have so much, Rob. And so it's like, even
yes,
like
this is the problem. So
even like little things you're like, where you normally would have to do on your own. It's like punch into Wirecutter. It's like, nah, shit. Like they will tell me which like snowblower I should get. And it's like,
wow, like, that's the most suburban fucking, like Patrick's out here like looking for snowblowers. I'm like, yeah, which sheets should I get for my bed? Yep. Like, which, like, what is going to be the,
that
like,
isn't the podcast ad sheets?
Well, right. Not that I'm opposed to podcast ad sheets. I would love to be sent a complimentary set of sheets
Are you expressing
the joy that you and I have both had where you do a podcast read and then they're just like, here's some money to just go buy stuff.
There's some stuff that I can fucking get behind. Like, Patrick, you and I need to record a new ad.
I want
to
sell out. I feel differently
than I did when I recorded that first ad.
You guys can be wearing your cool things, sitting on cool sheets, eating your football meat together, watching a football game.
The sports meat.
Footballmeat.com, sponsor us.
So this is the thing, is like, time was, I would be like, look, I just need to find like 400 thread count sheets makes me feel fancy. It makes me feel like I'm going to a nice hotel. So I just need that. Like, what has good reviews? And now I'm like, oh, damn, I don't want to get the wrong sheets. I better go to Wirecutter. But Wirecutter isn't crowdsourced, right? Wirecutter is like expert opinion. Right. Like, it is here. And they also show their work. Amazon, meanwhile, wants you to buy a counterfeit item of the thing you actually want. Like, that's Amazon's whole, like, their incentive. Is like, what if you had to buy the same thing twice, one of which is fake and might be dangerous?
It won't light on fire immediately. Just in like 6 months, you might want to have to buy another one. Amazon, the way I use the data available on Amazon is quantity of review. Right? Not as like an end all be all, but just like, all right, like I'm looking to, I don't know, buy some new pens. And it's like, I've never really thought about buying pens. So like, I look them up and it's like, okay, within a price range I'm willing to spend, generally like something that has 20 reviews versus like 4,500 reviews. Like, oh, that's at least like a metric I can think about that probably 4,500 reviews that are all five stars haven't been falsified.
It's not
like,
all
just
fake.
The sheer I just say the sheer quantity at least like gives you a building block to think about for small stuff that I don't want to like go read a 12 because like I haven't gotten to the point where I'm looking up Wirecutter reviews of pens. Although now I'm wondering, do they have reviews of pens?
Patrick, I got you covered on pens. Don't worry about
okay.
it.
Okay,
that one, like believe me, you're stepping into like
I'm
at
going
that
to the
point,
Wirecutter, and then I'm going to Rob
in-house counsel for that one.
No, but I mean that is my procedure, Danielle. I'm like, I got to do my research. Increasingly now, that research does happen at Wirecutter for like fancier electronics. It happens at Wirecutter and CNET. But Wirecutter is a little more accessible in terms of like who they're writing for. I think CNET tends to like. They show their work a lot, and it can be a little bit overwhelming. Yeah. But I will, go to the council and ask people, what they think of a thing, and then I look at my bank account and adjust my expectations.
Yeah. And cry in a corner in my not fancy sheets. Yes.
Right. I'm sitting here. I'm like, I'd like a blanket. I want a blanket. I can't afford the blanket I want. I'm like sitting here saving up for a blanket. I'm like, got it.
Rob,
like,
what's that jar of pennies behind you?
Is that the blanket?
Yeah, it's the blanket fund. Oh.
Christmas tree used to be is now just a bucket of pennies.
Damn, you can see the fucking penny bucket, huh?
Got good eyes.
I'm saving up to get a nice blanket that isn't a comforter. So that I can like, adjust for whatever the heat level is. Not in the like GTA sense, not like I'm going to bed and like I've committed crimes. I'm like, gotta go to like more the like,
it's
what
a different
is the temperature?
Blanket
right. It's like I need a camo blanket. But I think to redirect to like a slightly larger theme here, I think in terms of accountability, a lot of places with like, I think the trend in like politics and like major and big business has tended to be kind of a certain shamelessness, a refusal to even like grant the premise that you can be held to account, that you can be shamed. I think in the tech space, though, it is a studied and self-serving cluelessness about the entire thing. It is a pretense that, oh, we just have no idea what the fuck is going on in our platform. And like with a guy like Jack, his stupidity is almost helpful for like Twitter, because you can almost believe that he's like naive enough and clueless enough that he might not really get what's going on, because a lot of things seem to like sort of go past him. And you're sort of left wondering, is that is that an affectation or is that the real article? But if you look at the overall trend, it can't just be a series of accidents. Like, Silicon Valley people are ridiculous. But in general, there's the thing you find again and again is a reaction of, oh, we're as surprised as anyone that our data is being abused. We're as surprised as anyone that Stormfront are running campaigns on our fucking movie review website. Ugh. Wild, huh? Yeah. Golly gee, technology's crazy.
I think it was funny. I was reading, can't remember where I heard it or read it, but there was Jack Dorsey's been doing like rounds of interviews the last like month or so. You should. We never got around to doing it as a waypoint. Please just go read the Ashley Feinberg interview with Jack Dorsey on Huffington Post, or I guess Huff Post as it's called now. It's beautiful. But there was one of them circulating around where he was like, because Jack Dorsey also runs or is part of Square, which is like a very successful like tech company that like first started as like an easy way for realtors, especially small realtors, to retail outlets to like sort of like, you know, use phones for money and charge credit cards and things like that. And so you would see those Square readers going around that could either be plugged into iPads or have their own thing. Anyway, like that company is sort of like slowly dotting along and apparently like doing very well for itself. It's very well run. Aren't a lot of huge problems. And then Twitter is just fucking just a firestorm, just a constant problem. And someone asked like the difference in approach for those, you know, to kind of explain some of that. And he, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but said something along the lines of like, well, that's people's money. We have to take it very seriously. And so we're very methodical about the steps we take there. And then there's Twitter. And so I feel what's revealing about that is not that he's stupid. It's that they're callous and they don't care. Like, there's a willful callousness with how they treat how people are using like their very powerful amplifying social network. And so whereas we're like, oh, it's people's money. Like, oh, well, we can't fuck that up. We got to make sure there's no Nazis doing bank stuff on Square, but don't worry, they can spread their ideology on Twitter just fine. Like, what if you took the same level of seriousness, you know, across those two? Clearly, right now, you're not, and it's profitable if you don't. So, you know, absent a Congress that's going to hold you accountable for your fuck-ups, you know, all we can do is just keep yelling shame and hoping that Ashley Feinberg gets to do more interviews.
Well, we will leave it there, and we're going to take a quick break. Kato, you got me on that one, right? We'll take a quick break. In the meantime, shout outs to Mark, and enjoy this ad.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
And we're back. So my waypoint this week is a podcast that I've come to late. It's pretty far along in its life cycle. But I'm currently in the middle of one of its better series, and this is Mike Duncan's Revolutions podcast. And specifically, I've been into the third series on the French Revolution that he's done. Now, if you don't know Mike Duncan, you probably know his previous podcast, The History of Rome, which was one of those like wildly popular history podcasts. I never got into it because, I have a degree in it, so it's just not my, like... Like, I was like, man, I lived that life. I don't know if I need it to be my podcast for now. But so Duncan moved on from that to a series of podcasts exploring historical revolutions in the modern world. And it started with the English Civil War, which was a really fun opener. I will say, like, highly recommend that, if only because the English King Charles is one of the most unbelievably clueless dudes that you could, like, it is again, I would not expect a podcast about bloody revolutions to be so awkward, and cringe at times, but the English Civil War definitely fits that bill. But I thought the French Revolution series that he did for his third series was genuinely fascinating, in part because it is a topic I don't know a great deal about. My history, my knowledge of French history at this point sort of begins with the siege of Toulon and sort of ends as the Imperial Guard fall back at Waterloo. That's my understanding of the period. But this sort of gets into the antecedents of the French Revolution and really begins unpacking both how complicated it is, and it is enormously complicated. I definitely feel like I might... Danielle, you mentioned you were like re-listening to it.
Yep.
Which yeah, I probably I, should yeah, be doing.
Danielle yep. and I are probably on the same page. I listened to two episodes. I was like, if you asked me to write down what I've just learned, I'd be like... That's a great question.
I made it through 7 episodes, and I'm really excited.
Dang.
I'm really enjoying it. I listened to the second episode 3.5 times. Not the whole thing, but the first 15 minutes that are really setting up what the tax structure was like in the preceding period to the revolution itself. Just did not completely grasp that the first 3.5 times.
It's ungraspable. That's the other interesting thing, right? That's kind of the point, is like, it's meant to be like, what is this? Which I think he does a good job. Was there anything in that description of like the tax structure that really jumped out at you as like, this seems fucked?
Well, really the whole thing. But really just how much it was completely haphazard in one way. None of these structures, none of the ways in which it was basically a bunch of tiny little fiefdoms that all sort of kind of were collected in a certain way. None of them were organized under the same principles, which is the main issue here. You might have different rights and privileges in one of these areas than in another one of those areas. And depending on how well off you were, the easier it was for you to have access to resources. That certainly is a through line through all of this and through all of history, and also in America right now, of course, which is always the fun thing to learn about history as somebody who never really had a ton of history education beyond sort of high school. But yeah, really the main thing being none of it seemed like it came from any real structure or any real identifying factors of what would be even remotely that would make sense in a modern structure. It was just a mess that was sort of inherited from medieval times. Like, tiny little areas all had their own kind of thing going on, and that was all sort of vaguely united, but not very well.
It's this really interesting construct where he lays out how Louis XIV kind of formally brings France out of the Middle Ages in a lot of respects, but without resolving any of, like, the administrative cruft of that era. Like, he centralizes a country, basically, like, he centralizes power within himself. But in terms of administration, how the country actually runs, it's still this kind of ramshackle, like, well, okay, so in this province, you can tax priests this way. But in this province, actually, it's a completely different structure. And it doesn't really run. And how do you make political change or political will felt through the system? And the answer is kind of that you can't in a lot of ways. I think the other thing that I do like about this series is that there is a tendency, and this is probably the main thing I'm into about this series, there is a tendency for all things to look inevitable in hindsight.
Sure.
That we look at a subject and we know that, like with the French Revolution, we know that like the storming of Bastille is coming. And so everything gets shot through this lens of, well, okay, so from this series of problems, inevitably we are going to trend toward the fall of the Bastille and the execution of the royal family and the Reign of Terror. And what's interesting about this series is that because he breaks it down very much like a storyteller, he makes it clear, like, none of this is inevitable. Like, everything is so contingent, and it can actually hinge on these really weird chances, decisions, misunderstandings. And you can imagine how, yes, there's historical momentum at work, but you can also imagine, like, man, if someone had just been a little bit different, if people had had their shit just a little bit together, or if somebody just hadn't rubbed someone else the wrong way, things would have gone differently, and God knows how history looks.
That is my favorite thing about this. Again, thus far, not having heard the whole thing, but I don't know how far in 7 episodes is. I actually really have no clue. I haven't looked
it's
at the
weird.
Full list
think,
or anything.
I think his French Revolution series is like 40 episodes.
Holy
which
shit.
Which is wild, because I think his American Revolution series was like 18,
okay.
20.
Right.
So like this one is the deep end of the pool for sure.
So not even a quarter of the way in, but thus far really enjoying it. That is the thing I've been taking away the most is he puts these really, first of all, he's painting very colorful pictures, which always helps me, again, as somebody who does not have the greatest history education. There are so many gaps in my mind of pretty much every major period in every major country of history. I have like little bits and pieces that I read a cool book at one point, or my dad interested me in something at some point, that kind of thing. This paints a really great picture, and it does have that like, hey, if Louis the 16th had been a more compelling speaker, X, Y, and Z, here were 3 opportunities he could have had to change enough minds at this council. Things like that, those like really specific, like, here's a turning point, here's a turning point, here's a turning point that he's really highlighting. I find that very helpful as a listener like myself without that great background on this. So it's awesome so far.
I, like Danielle, do not have a like much of a history background beyond.
Where are you going with this, Patrick?
Like, I found this is not a podcast for beginners, is like to speak to the form.
Sure.
Right? Like, so like having listened to the first 2 episodes, getting to the end and being like, this person clearly knows what they're talking about. But like, I felt like at least the way I listen to podcasts is often doing other things, mm-hmm. right? I'm cleaning, I'm putting stuff away in the house. It is something that is an additive to other stuff I'm doing. You know, the result of that is probably why a lot of my podcasts are conversational in nature. So I think I've become trained to listen to a lot of like the most effective way of information being communicated to me in a podcast is actually in some sort of like conversational manner. And that can still be like reported, right? Like things like Slow Burn, I think are exceptional, are still mm-hmm. like kind of closer to that format. Whereas this one is a little more just like information being read to you. It's pretty flavorless. That doesn't mean that it's not good. Like I'm trying to describe like a very distinctive way yeah. of doing storytelling. But I felt like I needed to sit down and like, I need to listen to this and take notes. And because it's not that type of podcast, like what I wanted more was like, let's like slow down and like give a little more broader context of what's happening. And so if it feels like the kind of thing that I would go and read as a supplemental to something else where like that, or like I went and read the Wikipedia page on the French Revolution. And I was like, all right, I feel like I'm now better prepared to actually listen to this podcast than I was when I listened to it in the first place. So I'm curious. I don't know how this like the only other like I have a friend that's like really into hardcore history is like one of the other like really big history podcasts. So like I haven't listened to that one, but I don't know how this where this one fits in like sort of the pantheon of how different history podcasts choose to present themselves.
I like the approach here better than Dan. It's Dan Carlin, right?
Dan Carlin, yeah.
Which I have listened to several.
So I haven't listened to that one. So what's that approach?
It is just, I think I just don't love his politics that much. Like, mm-hmm. dude is like enamored with Teddy Roosevelt and stuff like that. So
I'm not sure I like Mike Duncan's either. Like, I like this podcast and fundamentally I think he's okay, but the politics I want to get to you in a second. But
yeah, please.
So that's interesting.
Please, yeah. I'm finding this easier to take. Because he does have, like you said, I know you had mentioned this in the notes, he does certainly show his own political leanings, but less so than Dan Carlin. I feel like Dan Carlin is really this like kind of moderate dude who is madly in love with the great men of history. He has a really sensational way of speaking. Mm-hmm. Dan Carlin does. Sorry to make it specific here. Really sensational. Like, oh my God, he's doing the, you know, he's really like fashions himself as an orator, you know, standing at his pulpit, teaching you some shit for 5 hours at a time about history stuff, which is stirring and something I've enjoyed while like playing games or things like that. But his politics have gotten in the way for me. Whereas Mike Duncan, this guy?
Yeah.
Okay. His have not yet gotten in the way for me necessarily, and that might be a quirk of this specific season. It might be a quirk of me not knowing his politics as much as Dan Carlin throughout hearing so many of his other podcasts. But please do tell about some of your issues with it.
No, but it's a hard thing to put your finger on,
sure,
right? Yeah. Like, so I think with Dan Carlin, there's an approach. What is most engaging and compelling about history a lot of times is the amazing stories you get to tell. And that's sure. how a lot of people are drawn into it. Then as you get more serious about your study of history, you learn that those stories you're told are often really simplified, streamlined. They leave a lot of things out, increasingly like have an agenda or an angle. And then the further you get into history, the less romantic you get about it at all. And you start approaching this knowledge that like everything is a complicated morass, like teasing out like what happens, even in really well-documented situations with like clear outcomes, is still really difficult to do from the benefit of hindsight. When you're talking about a thing like the French Revolution, you're talking about things that aren't recorded very well. Gender dynamics among the French peasantry in the 18th century. Like, we know some about that, but do we actually, like, know what it was like? Do we know what, like, the discourse around that was? That's harder to tell. I think there's a couple things with Mike Duncan. One is that, in the end, his first duty, I think, is to the story. Mm-hmm. And if you're focusing on the story, you're necessarily going to increasingly be telling a version of history that centers on great men. Now, I think Duncan, to his credit, also does try particularly, well, the French Revolution, women also start playing a more and more important role in it. But he does try to speak to larger sociological trends and economic trends of the moment and not just make it about, and then this dude did this.
Yeah.
But when the chips are down, he will gravitate toward the colorful anecdote and sort of the knowing, like, wry, sardonic comment about, isn't this guy a schmuck?
Yeah.
The analogy I use a lot is Shelby Foote in the Ken Burns Civil War documentary series is a great speaker, but he becomes increasingly grating because he just loves the stories of the Civil War and the colorful characters it is, and doesn't seem to engage as much with like the content of the issues. The other thing is, I think Duncan, in the process of doing the series, you can almost detect his growing skepticism of radical revolutionary action. Definitely, he has a very positive feeling about the American Revolution and the people who led it. And I think that kind of is revealing about his politics. He's critical, but like not as critical as maybe a lot of these guys deserve.
Sure.
And then as the French Revolution continues, you can sort of see like there's almost an element where it just feels in the story he tells, he almost has more sympathy for the moderates and conservatives who are like trying to put the brakes on things, and he's a little more skeptical of the people who want to burn it all down. Even though the story he lays out, you're kind of sitting there being like, I could see why you'd want to see that fucker burn.
Yeah. I almost wonder, and this is completely, having only listened to 7 episodes of this series and nothing else of his, I almost wonder, because this season is from 2014, almost wonder if he would have more sympathy in 2019, after seeing maybe some of the things that have happened in life, or maybe understood some of the sentiment towards at least some light revolutionary sentiment in the American left at this point. But again, this is me completely being like, I'm listening to this in 2019, and it's post, you know, Trumpian politics, yeah, and all that kind of stuff. I don't know him at all, so I can't speak to that. But I do wonder on some level about that.
Well, I think one of the things, so I did hear him speak about when he was covering, I think, the Russian Revolution, or possibly the revolutions of 1848. I can't remember which, but he appeared on Chapo to talk a little bit about his attitude to revolutions. And he still sounded a little, like, he sounded like the politics that you hear in 2014 are still basically his politics. In his defense, though, I think one of the threads running through revolutions is that none of this unfolds according to design.
Right.
And a lot of these revolutions that he covers and a lot of these stories he ends up telling end up unleashing a whole lot of, like, pain and disaster, including on people who have the best of intentions, don't always, frequently fail to translate into, like, meaningful positive change for the majority of people in a society. That utopian action, the radical action, tends to sort of consume itself or tends to be redirected into some bad ends, or tends to produce a reactionary backlash that takes you to a worse place than you started from. So I think if revolution sort of has a bias, it's that it is skeptical of the forces that are being unleashed in these stories it tells, and it thinks they should be treated with a great deal of respect and wariness.
Rob, I wonder, is having listened to two episodes in which he's a storyteller, but you don't feel like there's a lot of him in the story he's telling. He's like, oh, I went and did the research. Here's the story I'm telling about what happened. Is like some of your suspicion because there's a lack of more of the author in the work itself, and where like if you knew a little bit more of where he landed on things, not where he's got to like, hey, side note, here's what I think about like the decision that was made here or why these people did or didn't do this thing, but like the pure like it's very bland in its approach, like for on purpose, but by lacking that, you have to do more of your own research or suspicions to try and eke out like, well, what are you actually saying here based on what you're prioritizing? Because every retelling of history is in itself political because you are picking and choosing the subjective, you know, nature of how you're presenting the information. So, you know, by lacking a lot of that in his approach to storytelling, does it inevitably like lead you to have to start wondering, well, why did you choose this? How did you land at this? Because he's not outright telling it to you as part of the storytelling.
I think there's a bit of that. In that you end up kind of trying to fill in blanks based on how he's telling the story and what he's presenting. But I don't know. So, Danielle, you probably got to this part. There is a sequence where Louis XVI has a chance to almost like put a cork in this.
Yes.
It's because what triggers all of this is a series of things. One, France has a series of like bad harvests, which sort of like fuck up their agrarian economy. But the big thing is the country is wildly bankrupt and they've been fudging the numbers for years to cover this. And I'm curious, like, there's a deal cut that is almost going to resolve this. Danielle, I'm curious, do you feel in the way he tells that story, like there's something he almost wishes happened?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. That it's Louis XVI, I believe, at this point in history, that he was a better speaker, that he was better able to convince people, that he was better suited to being a king, really, and sort of leading people towards a particular path. Because it sounded like, I might not get the person's name right, so I'm just going to say, a person came up with a set of proposals that were going to basically restructure the tax structure, get more money flowing, do a lot of the things that needed to be done, kind of bring a lot of people on board from different provinces and kind of make them work together to some degree. And they were beginning to agree on some of this stuff. And I don't remember the exact failing, but the person who created this proposal apparently was not super compelling. He ended up bad-mouthing the nobles in like a newspaper, like not newspaper, whatever at the time would have been basically an op-ed, threw it
out
there.
They're all broadsheets, yeah.
Right, like I am definitely paraphrasing with my own modern understanding of how word is spread. But he basically shot himself in the foot by doing that. And the king himself could have pushed through some of this legislation. He could have been more compelling. He could have actually been, you know, the guy to get it done. But he was really uninterested in a lot of the sort of craft of policymaking and, you know, what kings do at this point in life and actually sort of getting in there and getting his hands dirty with this sort of policy. And that was one of the major failings that it sort of caused everything to collapse was this turning point could have really, really, really been, hey, we're fixing some shit and it's going to take a while, but we're fixing some shit versus, oh, it's all going up in flames because we couldn't get that right person to actually be a leader, get there, get the boots on the ground to get this policy kind of going. That was my understanding of it. It's an oversimplification, but that was kind of my understanding that Mike Duncan here is like, God damn it. Not everybody didn't have to die. You know, we could have done this with policy, which is like a beautiful thing to think.
Kind of the centrist, like, damn it. Like,
kind of centrist, like,
if
though,
only
yeah.
the process could have been allowed to work.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing is, like, I think to a degree, he is a little dull and a little, like, dry, Patrick. But at the same time, he also seems like somebody who imagines how the system could have worked and been reinvented and people could have reinvested and re-legitimized a decaying political order. And that in itself, I think, is like if that's what you're choosing to focus on. And particularly, like, there's this one cringe moment where basically a deal has been cut, and all Louis has to do is show up to this meeting and like put his name to it. And Louis falls asleep in the middle of the meeting. And it is such an incredibly like disrespectful seeming move. And it kind of like scuppers a lot of the legitimacy and enthusiasm for the deal in the first place. And then he starts like ad-libbing what he was going to say in his formal remarks over this deal. And there's this feeling you get in the way he tells the story that like, damn it. Like, if only he'd been a better king, we could have... And the answer is, could have what, right? Like, what would that deal have accomplished? It could have kicked the can further down the road? Could have... And so I think that ends up being the one frustrating thing with Duncan's politics is that... And I get it. It's the people who end up getting, like, totally wrecked in history a lot of times end up being kind of underdogs that you sort of, like... almost pull for it, like, it doesn't have to go this way. You don't need to be this doomed. But I also think there's something political about the way he tells the story of by focusing on like the inflection points that caused the status quo to be lost, which is an interesting angle for a Revolutions podcast. But nevertheless, I think it's interesting. It does dig into stuff that maybe you haven't like learned too much about if your product like me and Danielle of a American high school education covering world history in the space of two semesters when you're 15, 16. But it's still a podcast well worth listening to. This is definitely one of the denser. Nice. And there is it's such a complicated revolution, but it makes for a fascinating subject.
I will say I listened to about half of the interview he did with Chapo, and like I found that to be like more informative as a gateway in, because it, again, like my own biases and preferences, like it was that conversational tone where it's like there was just a little more explaining that was happening as they were talking through things. So it almost might even be worth for people who are curious and maybe you are sympathetic to like, you know, my own reaction to it, like maybe listen to that interview first. It kind of like gives you some groundwork to work with before you jump into the podcast itself.
Who's ready for some football?
Man, it's February. It's still snowing. It's not.
The AAF is on.
I am ready for some football.
All right.
I don't have any draft picks,
look,
but I'm
there's
ready.
There's no football right now, but what there is is the NFL Scouting Combine.
Yeah.
So, Danielle.
Yes.
You don't give a shit about football. But this caught your eye.
I have complex feelings.
That's what intrigues me.
I have complex feelings about football, which is, you know, to make it real quick, I think the game is fascinating and awesome and really cool. I hate the NFL because they're a bunch of assholes. And the way that football is played, the way most professional sports are done in this country is pretty fucked up and bad. But this combine was fascinating to me because it connected, I think, a few things that I find fascinating in sports, especially the way it's sort of connected to the way we look at athletes in combat sports as well. But just generally, this is a short piece on SB Nation about the combine itself. It's titled, "I Went Through the NFL Combine. These Were the Most Awkward Parts." And it's from a retired lineman, Jeff Swartz, who talks about what it was like to go through this combine where people who are very, very, very elite level college football players, or I suppose you guys tell me, because again, I do not follow the NFL super, super closely, but is it possible to not be a college athlete? I suppose like a really high level high school football player could go through this potentially?
No, they have walk-ons. I don't know if this necessarily is that period. I don't know the exact mechanisms. Like, it is possible. I think there is.
I think some people are invited to the combine.
Sure.
If they like. But in general, this is the place where people about to graduate potentially into the NFL. That is the predominance of who you'll find there.
Yeah.
And then also do veteran players sometimes show up at this thing if they're trying to demonstrate that like they're healthy again, that they're...
I don't think so. I think that might be something separate. Like, this is largely about like quarterbacks coming in, throwing balls, the measurement stuff that we'll get into with the article that Danielle linked. And like a lot of what happens at the combine is people's like draft sort of like stock rising or falling. So it's like maybe you'll have a player come in that people are like, oh yeah, that seems pretty good, might go in like the third or fourth round, And then he runs like, was it the 3-4? Isn't that what they call it? Where the sprint that they do. And it's like, oh, he's like super fucking fast and has a great combine. But suddenly he might be like a second or first round pick, or someone comes in and they're overweight and it's like, oh, you know, maybe, you know, this person's lazy and they weren't prepared for the combine, so they're going to slip down. So there's a lot of that sort of like draft jockeying that happens. And the draft is in April, so it's like a month and a half out or something like that.
Yeah. All right, cool. So, yeah, basically this is like an apparatus for determining the fitness of these athletes, both their minds and their bodies. And their minds, to some extent, I suppose, in some really weird and borderline content warning, borderline abusive sounding practices, frankly, to see if like this athlete can be made to cry, basically, during certain portions of the interview. But they come on and they actually go ahead and this started in the 80s, it sounds like, and it continues to go through. It's like a huge testing of these athletes to the point where there's one passage that really, really struck me that was basically they are sort of lined up and it sounded like a U-shaped formation of like desks where doctors go around and make measurements. So, yeah, here it is. I'll just read this tiny part. There's a portion for measurements, and then after measurements, it's time for medical checks. This is a long, all-caps process. The team split up into six different rooms, and each player must take a turn in each room. The rooms are set up in the same way. The tables are arranged in a U formation for all the team doctors and trainers. The players sit on the table in the middle of the room. This just sounded like almost like a in a horror movie, you know, set in the 1800s where, you know, you're in the medical theater or something and they're demonstrating, you know, there's a body on the table and the sort of mad scientist or the mad scientist professor is like poking and prodding at this body and being like, here, students, look at his biceps. They are X big. It's this really wild image in my head of this kind of going on. And everything is measured. Their muscles, their sort of you know, their wingspan, the length of their legs, the length of their head, like all these incredibly detailed measurements are made, ostensibly to you know, sort of determine their fitness or their relative fitness to play alongside other athletes that have been measured to this degree. There's something about this that is really fascinating. I guess I should also mention these interviews. They're done, it sounds like they have sort of normal interviews that are actually sort of getting to know this person as a player, as a person, how well they would get along with other people. And also, there's an allusion here to someone's job as a coach was to interview people and see if they could make this person cry under like any...
Yeah, do you want me to... I'm gonna
love to get Voight Kampft yeah. for my football job.
Right?
Well, let me read you. There's a an article from USA Today, one of their sports sections, where they collected. This is from February 2017 by Stephen Ruse, I believe is how you pronounce his name. Here are some of the questions that people were asked at these interviews. Do you find your mother attractive? Do you like men? When did you lose your virginity? Is your mother a prostitute? What's your murder weapon of choice? Would you rather be a cat or a dog? Where are you sitting on a bus speeding on a mountain? Where does the sun rise and where does it set? Also, side note, Rob, wasn't that the thing that Jared Goff didn't know where the sun came?
Oh, no.
Rose and set? Wasn't that in Hard Knocks a couple of years back?
Yeah, I can't remember.
True. I feel like that's true. Would you share your internet history with us? What color is chocolate? Boxers or briefs? How many ways could you use a brick in a minute? What team do you pick in Madden? What kind of fish are you? Are you afraid of clowns?
Okay. Read these lines from Pale Fire.
Right. Your baseline's way off, man.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just wild.
So the thing is, like, if there were a league that embodies white supremacy, it's the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
And
just largely white people just inspecting
yes.
and deconstructing black bodies.
Yes.
Yes. And the combine is kind of the most overt, like, just symbolically, like, it is like put these athletes up on the stand, go over them, like, you know, check their joints, check their teeth. And like, I was also surprised, like, details that just creep me out, like him talking about having strained his knee like 2 years earlier, and the doctor touches his knee and is like, that MCL feels loose.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Whoa.
it's banana. And there's a person, somebody had 13 MRIs, like in this one day, 13 MRIs. Like it's the amount. There's also a portion of this that is bananas to me as somebody who follows a little bit. And my sister works in the world of like medical aid in countries in conflict areas and things like this. Like how many MRIs they have here? They have. It's almost like, okay, these resources to microscopically, analyze these athletes, not literally microscopically, but to a really, really, truly fine point. It's like this technology could go to the people who are, again, I'm oversimplifying, but like people who are literally being bombed in another country and who really need some of this medical equipment. But we have like however many MRI machines right here to make sure that MCL that was loose for one game. It was what, his freshman season. He missed no practice and zero games.
Yeah.
And like had the tiniest little twinge to it. Like that's the degree that we're talking about. And it's like there's something really, really American and capitalist about this entire system of using this much of a resource to ensure that we're not getting any players who have ever had any injury ever and have no chance of these injuries and all of these things playing this wildly violent game where everyone will be injured eventually. Are there any athletes who play football who have never been injured? Does that even exist, really?
Well, I mean, like I posted these in our Discord. I want to read a couple
yes,
of these.
Yes, please do.
Tweets from Todd McShay, who I don't know if he's like a draft analyst. I'm not familiar with what specifically he does. It's not listed in his Instagram is TM McShay. I don't know. Someone else figure it out. Anyway, he's got hundreds of thousands of followers and does stuff about football. But okay, so he had a couple of tweets about as the combine is kicking off. Alabama OT, offensive tackle, Jonah Williams, 5 1/8 inch arm length doesn't prevent him from playing OT in the NFL, but certainly won't help his cause. Ideally, 34 and 1/2 inches or longer. Ohio State OC Mike Jordan measures at 6'5" and 7/8" and 312 pounds with 34 1/4 arm length. Great size. I think he's an underrated player on tape. Stanford running back Bryce Love, 5'8" and 7/8" and 200 pounds. Alabama running back Josh Jacobs, 5'10", 220. Both as expected. I mean, the offensive tackle is the one in particular where it's like, 33 and 5/8, it ain't no 34 and a half. It's just like, like, I'm sure, like, given, like, there are probably statistics that, like, look at this in a spreadsheet that's like, ideally, this is what you want out of, like, an idealized body. Like, I see how you arrive at that, but it is so fucking weird to see it just, like, put down taking a person's body and just reducing it to those measurements.
It's a lot like, oh, sorry, go ahead, Rob.
I was just going to say that also I'm not entirely sure how predictive those stats actually are of someone's ability to, like, how many times, like, for instance, by any measure, Darren Sproles, who's one of the best running backs to play in the league, should not have been an NFL player. People were saying this from the start of his career. He's too small to play in the NFL. He just didn't like
Russell Wilson is also a good good example of that.
Right,
like a very small quarterback who should get crushed and not be able to play.
Isn't Tom Brady kind of small for a quarterback? I know we hate him. I'm not saying he's great. I'm just saying, isn't he on the smaller side of quarterbacks?
I can't remember why. I can't remember what the reservations were.
He did get drafted very late.
Yeah. There was something.
But I don't know exactly why that was.
But there's also bias toward, like, quarterbacks need to be tall, right?
Yeah.
How could you possibly how could you possibly throw the ball over the line if you're not tall enough? And there are a lot of players who like break that mold, but it happens often enough that I kind of wonder to what degree are stats like this really that predictive of some, like, a lineman's art isn't about their wingspan. It maybe helps, but actually, it's more about, like, how well do you anticipate? How well do you move? I don't know. I suppose, like, maybe how well does a weight predict? How well does weight and reach predict how someone's going to do in the ring, Danielle?
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of what I wanted to sort of connect this with, because the sport that I practice, I have a weight limit. Like when I compete, I have a specific target weight that I need to make, specifically, you know, myself personally. And also in MMA, the wider world of MMA, there's like very, very specific weight limits. And it's only a weight limit. They're not talking about, there's no limits, at least for things like wingspan and height and things like that, even though MMA athletes are also measured in a lot of these same ways, like in terms of how tall are you? What's your muscle mass? What's your composition? Like they have like a UFC Performance Institute now in Las Vegas that will do things like your very specific punching power, like how much force you can put into a punch, things like that, like these very, very, very specific stats. And yet the very, very, very best MMA fighters are often the people who have the most, God, the term is like ring intelligence or cage intelligence or whatever, fight IQ. People who do the best are exactly what you're saying, Rob, like the people who are able to really kind of take what they've got and make the most of it, whether or not they are really the most physically impressive athlete who has ever existed. There are people in MMA who are like really physically impressive specimens, right? There's a current welterweight champion, Tyron Woodley. I think he's still the champion. He is like this amazing athlete. John Jones, an amazing, amazing athlete. But a lot of people who are great, great, great fighters are not necessarily elite athletes. I think we talked about this a tiny bit when we were talking about Jen Locke a little bit, about how like in a lot of Olympics and a lot of other sports that have been around for much longer, probably football would be in this as well. These athletes, they basically have like tiny mutations. Like they have these sort of ideal bodies that they were kind of born into and trained into. But for something like MMA, and I don't know where football ends on this exactly, whether or not these are people who have these like almost, I mean, mutation sounds like a little wild, but I'm really talking about like, okay, you have a specific type of muscle composition. You have a particular gene that has made you more disposed to having more fast-twitch muscle fibers or slow-twitch muscle fibers or things like that. It is really wild to me on so many levels how obsessed we are with the numbers when we don't know necessarily what these numbers mean, because they don't always translate into performance in all of these ways. So, yeah.
Yeah, this is something that I tend to get really skeptical of. It's like something I think a lot about, for instance, is that, and you hear, again, I refer to him a lot because he's a smart commentator, but Monty Jones on mm-hmm. ESPN talked about like how one of the most important jobs on an NFL team is quarterback. It's crapshoot as far as like, they have not figured out how to evaluate or draft these guys. So, like, to what degree is this scientism, but mm-hmm. not science, mm-hmm. right? Like that's the thing that like I read a report like this, and to what degree is all this quantitative data really producing useful information,
or is it
versus
them just convincing themselves like we have to try and pick through these, we have to sort through these people somehow, and so we will come up with some sort of data that we think is predictive, but we're not really sure. But if you're there's a list of people, like why this one over the other one? Like there's very like it seems like what you're getting at, Rob, is like when you look at like, you know, folks have been like drafting the NFL over the last, you know, 10 years, like there are very like few times where there is a collective agreement over like, this is a transcendent talent that immediately is just going to be amazing. And that is just taken for a fact. And then also becomes fact. Like, I think maybe like Andrew Luck is like one of the last times that's happened in the last 10 years. So people are like, this guy's going to come in. He's going to be one of the best quarterbacks in the league immediately. And that just happened. That just was true. Now that's probably shown through the body of work, in college where like that just became like overt. But I think like what's revealed through this is just how rare moments like that are. And so you have to like, I don't know, you end up coming up with things that you hope are predictive, but are at the end of the day, probably just hopelessly giving you justifications for why you're picking one person over the other. And like, that's probably why it's a quasi mixture of like this, like psych tests and like physical attributes. Like if it is both, like I actually felt one of the more revealing ones in the piece was where there's a test they have to take in which you're like not really expected to finish it, but it's mostly to see like how far you can get through these rapid fire questions. And basically in order to finish it, you have to like you would have to do each question in like 14 seconds or something like that. And the author points out that, you know, if you think about it in football terms, generally, like when you're calling a play or like diagnosing a play, like you have about 14 seconds for everything to sort of happen. And so what the questionnaire is actually doing is not really testing your like necessarily your football IQ. It's more like your ability to diagnose a problem in real time and then do something about it, which that is kind of interesting. I don't know. Again, I don't know if that actually, you know, the ability to bullshit your way through a question, does that actually reveal your ability to like read a defense and where they're putting the safety? I don't know, but reading stuff like this more than anything is probably maybe tells you how soft the foundation actually is for player evaluation. And I wonder how true that is of just football, or if that is like just more broadly true in, you know, sports.
And I also wonder how much of this, maybe some of these measurements would be more applicable to sports with fewer variables in the playing of the sport. Swimming, for example, where there are the fewest, obviously there are differences. I'm sure there are differences in things like water temperature or using a different bathing suit or whatever. But in general, there are fewer variations in swimming 800 meters in one pool versus another pool or that kind of thing versus a sport where there is a lot of chaos, even within a play, there are a lot of variables. The ball could go any which way. Anybody could be maybe a little faster, a little slower, X, Y, and Z. A million variables are kind of going on. I don't know. It sure feels like a lot of this is incredibly arbitrary. And yeah, we're almost laughing at it a little bit, but it is also like there is a very uncomfortable racial element, which I know we touched on a tiny bit. And obviously not all football players are people of color, but so many of them are. And there is an aspect of this that makes me uncomfortable, even in MMA, when, you know, people's bodies are being very much commented on, men and women. They're almost naked when they're fighting in a cage. You know, men are typically wearing like just shorts. Women are typically wearing, you know, just shorts and like a little sports bra. And people, to their credit, most announcers, like, you know, the legit announcers are not saying like anything gross or sexualized necessarily about the athletes. That is one good thing about MMA, is that the women athletes, for all the shit that they take and have taken over the years, because it's a somewhat newer sport, they do make a little bit more in line with pay parity. Like, you know, the if you're a superstar woman, you might make as much as a superstar man. You might make as little as a guy who's just sort of a journeyman as well. But you're still commenting very specifically on people's bodies in a really, really, really overt way. You know, the ref might literally make an adjustment on like a woman's sports bra if she's in like a weird entanglement, basically. And they're doing that so that she, because her arms are literally wrapped up in the other person, they're grappling. She can't do anything about it. So this is not like, oh, the ref isn't being gross and like touching her in an inappropriate way. But there is a way in which these people's bodies are being commodified. They are out there. We are looking at them. We are judging them for their bodies. We are judging them for if they made weight or not, things like that, that I think can be really uncomfortable if we look at it on anything past sort of that face value and look at like, okay, you really are judging another human being's worth based on their size in a lot of ways, which is, I think, an inherently fairly uncomfortable thing and a wild thing to think about.
Yeah, I think there is this element of a lot of athletics are about commodified bodies and performance, but some sports are somehow more off-putting about it, I think. And particularly like the more violent ones, I suppose, both because at that point you're getting more into the blood sport aspect of it. The like, yes, it is about athleticism. It is about athletic ability. It is also about what we are about to inflict on these finely tuned machines. And that makes it especially upsetting when you see then this kind of careful evaluation. But also it does to a degree feel a bit to me like, again, you know, the illusion of precision, because, you know, in a lot of the fight game, certainly in football, as you said, Danielle, these are complicated, dynamic, fluid environments that do not lend themselves to clean quantification. It's not like in basketball, you can like have a heat map of how does a player shoot from these positions? Like what outcomes have we observed from here? And you have a pretty clear idea of who that player is based on that. Baseball is kind of the perfect statistical sport. And so there's a body of work that is very useful to judge from. Football, I don't know. I'm sure, Patrick,
the analytics revolution of football is, only just starting. So, I think it was only in this past season where the NFL, all the jerseys, track what the players are doing, and at the end of the season, all the teams get access to the data so they can see, what players are doing. And so you can see that stuff, spreading to college, and then suddenly we have, different ways of interpreting what is or isn't, a good fit for the NFL that is different than whether your fingers should be or your arm should be another half an inch. Not that that stuff isn't, predictive in some sense.
I don't know.
Go ahead.
Maybe this applies to the average draftee, right? Maybe we know about Darren Sproles because he turned out to be a generational talent who doesn't fit this model. And so always it's, when he came to the NFL, it's, will he hold up? Can he play in the game? 10 years later, it's shit. That guy's awesome and still doing it. But does this work as an evaluative metric for the NFL drafts hundreds of players? Does this method produce, for the most part, good data? I have no idea.
You could almost, if you want to show how tough it is to get quality drafts, whatever my feelings on the New England Patriots and what they represent, they're an incredibly effective organization that are very good at scouting players. They're the best at finding players that other teams have tossed into the garbage, and they pick them up and go, let's go get a ring. But they also have drafted terribly for the last 5 years. And so it's if they can't figure it out, then that probably tells you something about how difficult it is and how little teams actually know about what they can pull off in this process. Because if anyone would have figured it out, Bill Belichick would have figured it out by now. And so it's if he's still fumbling in the draft, that probably tells you you don't learn very much until they're actually just playing in the NFL. And then you can figure out what to do with them from there.
All right. So that will do it for our waypoints for this week. I got to go deal with an entire smoke detector situation.
Do you want to make some more holes in your wall?
Yeah. This time I'm going to fix it.
Yeah.
Does that make the hole bigger?
Or add a new one. I think just go upstairs and rip this thing out of the ceiling. We'll see what's going to happen. But anyway, our thanks to Tumelo for the track Slide Asleep off the album After Midnight. You can find that at tumelomakes.bandcamp.com. I keep turning this microphone away from that part of my apartment where that sound is coming from, and hopefully that cuts down on it a little bit. You can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people find you?
At Patrick Klubik.
Danielle.
At Danielle R.I.
And you can find our producer also on Twitter at @A_Cotto_appears. Boom.
Yay, beep.
Done. Let it never be said. I didn't do anything for you. That'll do it for this week's Waypoints. We hope you've enjoyed the break. Be sure to rate and review us on your podcast platform of choice, if it allows such a thing. I think we're a 5-star cast, regardless of any audio issues that may crop up, regardless of any artifacts of editing that you may encounter in your time with us. Nevertheless, bearing all that in mind, I think we're 5 stars. We'll be back with Waypoint Radio on Friday. You should also be sure to listen to Be Good and Rewatch It, where this week me, Danielle, and Natalie revisited Clueless and tackled all the important questions about Clueless and its role in 1995's strange and unexpected Jane Austen revival. Hope you'll join us for that, and join us again next week for Waypoints. But until then, do not give in to astonishment.
Beep.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare tri-term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Yay.
Oh, you guys could hear it, huh?
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Rob, right there.
Rob, oh, to the point God. That I thought, because I had this issue a week ago, and so I was like, God damn it. I thought I bought a new one. Like, I thought we were
so
cool.
It's like, it's so present on the recording that you thought.
Well, no, it's so present that Discord was switching to your video.
Yep.
Like, it was like, oh, cool, Rob's talking. Switch, and I'm like,
beep.
But it happened. It would just happen for like a fraction of a second when the beep occurred, and I was like, oh, no, that's him. It's him. It's not me. It's not my beep.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Oh. Awesome.
It largely happened while you weren't talking, so I think they should be mostly something.
Yeah. Hopefully you can do the find and replace the version of that is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh.
Okay.
You really don't?
It's not like a thing people say, I don't think. You know, just take them to deep water and drown them. Like, whoever told you that, you might want to look back and reevaluate that relationship.
You know, in like, in
I feel
boxing,
like this is a hangout with Agent 47
Rob,
or something.
You watch boxing. You watch boxing.
I see my two-year-old and I'm just like, hey, you know what they say, Jessica. If you don't go potty, you take them to the deep end and drown them.
Rob, you watch boxing.
Not,
that's a term for like, just survive the early rounds and they'll get tired in the later rounds. That's the deep water and then you drown them.
Okay. That's so good. I'm like, you know, like when you got to kill someone, right?
Do you know that I'm a normal, well-adjusted adult? Hi. My name's Danielle.
Speaking of normal, well-adjusted adults, this Combine story is something.
It's really a lot.
And speaking of normal, well-adjusted adults, people review bombing Captain Marvel.
Yep.
God damn it.
Patrick, what do you think it says that your camera doesn't think you're a person?
Oh.
I don't know. Well, it's because I don't like to close the light. I like the light. And so it fucks with the focus.
It's true.
I mean, I could make this room darker, but.
No, you got to have
kind
that light.
There's got
to be a way.
Makeup.
I believe I've looked into it. I unfortunately I don't think you can do
a little foundation, a little blush.
Well, that's bit.
Just something that says like, "Yo, this is a face." And the computer's like the autofocus can be like, "That's a face."
Just draw a big smile, you know.
All right, I'm ready to clap in.
Oh, I actually have to clap today. Oh my god, this never happens. Yeah. Time that is. Okay, I'm ready anytime.
All right, we missed the top of the minute.
I know.
Well, because that's a boring number anyway, so. All right.
27?
It's
the 27.
17. 17.
Oh, fine.
17, 17, 17. Word.
27 would be too low. I'd lose it by then. I'd end up screwing it up because I'm just like,
all right,
too much tension
fair.
Built up between.
I was just like, it's the 27. Yeah,
I mean, fine. If one time we just want to go like, all right, three minutes from now.
Get ready. Yeah.
Real quick.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to get up a minute ago to rip my carbon monoxide detector out of the wall.
This just happened to me a week ago.
Only to discover that I had misidentified the source of the sound.
Oh, no! Rob!
And it is the upstairs smoke detector. So now I have a little boo-boo in the drywall. And now I've got a smoke detector that is chirping, that is hardwired into the ceiling, and I don't know how to make it stop chirping, but it keeps chirping. And Kato, you're just gonna have to monitor the recording for this last 20 minutes to catch that chirp because it's infuriating.
You should just be able to screw it off and take the battery out, and the battery should
These are really old, like these are like illegally
old
smoke detectors.
Oh, good.
I have a hole in my ceiling from where the other one went, because I went to do that, Patrick, and the screws just stripped out of the ceiling.
and the entire thing just came down.
And then we looked up the model, like this model does not exist anymore. Like they're illegal to install anymore. So
good.
Anyway, point is, got a little problem, and now I have a hole in my wall. Yep. And we're gonna work on that. So anyway, getting back to it.
It's all good. Oh, hi, Mark.
What's good is that if he edits it out, then people will just be wondering, what is it? What happened? What did I miss? Because you acknowledged that it happened. So definitely edit it out, because that's the superior version.
The true conundrum.
Man, honestly, I have no idea what happens with the final editions of a lot of these episodes. No. Like, I'm really curious. Like,
kind of, I could be getting roasted in the editing
all the time. Like, I would not know. I would be like, I'm sure Kato represented my interests ably in that. But like, I don't know. Does he?
I try my best.
A plus. All right. A plus job, Kato.
Well, we will leave it there, and we're gonna take a quick